One corporation was cited for more than 400 safety violations over a period during which 4,600 of its workers were injured and 9 were killed. 3 deaths were found to be caused by deliberate violations of federal safety standards, yet this company was never threatened with closure. The state virtually gives employers a license to kill workers. In 1970, Congress declared that causing the death of a worker by deliberately violating safety laws is a misdemeanor, not a felony, with a maximum sentence of 6 months in jail. This is half the maximum for harassing a wild donkey on federal land. In 2003, New York Times journalist David Barstow reported that an excessive number of workers were being decapitated on assembly lines, shredded in machinery, burned beyond recognition, electrocuted, buried alive. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration investigated 57% of these deaths and laid charges in only 7% of them, despite finding that, quote, between 1982 and 2002, a total of 2,197 workers were killed on the job because their employers willfully violated safety laws. With full knowledge of their responsibilities, they ignored accepted safety precautions, removed safety devices to speed up production, or denied workers protective gear, close quote. The body never lies. Productivity in America shot up in the first quarter of 2002 by 8.6% at an annual rate, the biggest leap since 1983. Employees worked longer and harder as unemployment rose. Higher productivity results from paying workers less than the full value of what they produce. When the media trumpet higher productivity and profits as great news for everyone, workers become confused. They are told that surrendering more of what they produce is good, even as their living conditions deteriorate. Do they trust what they are told, that they live in the best possible world? Or do they trust their experience, that life is getting harder? Going with your gut puts you in conflict with the system. Going with the system puts you in conflict with your gut. When people face such seemingly unsolvable problems, their bodies cry out in protest. The biological stress response developed as an emergency measure. You kill the bear, or the bear kills you. But what happens when you cannot get away? What happens when the threat you face comes from your job and from the society in which you live? Bodies subjected to continual stress adapt by dissociating from the awareness of being stressed so that stress feels normal. No matter how well people seem to adapt to stressful conditions, the body never lies about the true state of an organism. Bodies flooded with stress hormones respond with backaches, headaches, insomnia, fatigue, anxiety, depression, digestive and respiratory problems, chest pains, high blood pressure, recurring infections, rashes, allergies, muscular spasms, sexual and menstrual difficulties. These symptoms can be relieved with medicines, but there can be no cure as long as the individual is unjustly treated by society. As Michael Schneider wrote in Neurosis and Civilization, quote, as long as the working class does not rebel against these new and intensified forms of exploitation, heart, stomach, and circulatory diseases of individual workers will rebel for them. Even though the worker may still go along, his circulation in any event will not. If he says, actually, I feel all right, his stomach ulcer will prove the contrary, close quote. Inequality kills. As wealth flows upwards to the few, the many who produce it are increasingly impoverished. In 1970, the richest 0.1% of Americans took in 100 times the average annual income. By 2001, this same group enjoyed 560 times the average annual income. As surplus accumulates at the top of society, sickness and misery accumulate at the bottom, and not only from injuries, illnesses, and fatalities at work. Inequality itself is deadly. Human health is inextricably linked with equality. More unequal societies have overall higher death rates. A study of 282 metropolitan areas in the United States found that the greater the difference in income, the more the death rate rose for all income levels, not just for the poor. And the rise in death rates was substantial. Researchers calculate that reducing income inequality to the lowest level found in the United States would save as many lives as would be saved by eradicating heart disease or by preventing all deaths from lung cancer, diabetes, motor vehicle crashes, HIV infection, suicide, and homicide put together. Even greater benefits would flow from eliminating inequality completely. Consider the lives that would be saved by eliminating racism. Black people in the United States suffer almost 300 more deaths per 100,000 people than white people do. If there were no racism, the death rate for blacks and whites would be the same. Compare these 300 additional deaths with a much smaller U.S. murder rate of about 10 people per 100,000. Every year, racism kills 30 times more people than die at the hands of individual murderers. Inequality kills children. Even though the United States is the richest nation in the world, 42 nations have lower infant death rates. The infant mortality rate in Washington, D.C. is more than double the infant mortality rate in the capital of China. There are also 25 nations where the average lifespan is longer than it is in America. In Unhealthy Societies, the Afflictions of Inequality, Richard Wilkinson found that inequality is so harmful that poor people who live in nations with less inequality tend to be healthier and live longer than better off people who live in more unequal nations. Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries in the world. Yet Bangladeshi men are more likely to reach age 65 than black men living in Harlem, New York. Harlem men have greater incomes and a higher standard of living than Bangladeshi men. However, the U.S. is a much more unequal society. For one thing, black men in Harlem suffer more cardiovascular disease, which is linked with class and racial oppression. A classic study of the British civil service found that health deteriorates as social status falls. This deterioration in health cannot be explained by factors like smoking, exercise habits, and body weight. Most surprising, those near the top of the power structure have worse health than those at the top, even though their lifestyles are essentially the same. This relationship between power and health has been found in every nation studied, including the United States. Income differentials cannot explain these findings. The non-professional who earns as much money as the professional has significantly more health problems. The difference is one of power. Your place in the social hierarchy determines how much control you have over your life. And the less control people have, the more stress and stress-related illnesses they suffer. Those with little control over demanding jobs, like public servants and social service workers, have more than double the rate of cardiovascular disease compared to those who have more control. Those with less control are more likely to be overweight and develop high cholesterol regardless of age, amount of exercise, and smoking habits. Demanding work on its own is generally not related to poor health, unless there is also a lack of power. The most health-damaging jobs saddle workers with great responsibility, like finding housing for the homeless, while denying them the resources required to do the job, affordable housing. People working under sustained conditions of high demand and low control suffer three times as many heart problems, three times as much back pain, five times as many cancers, two to three times as much interpersonal conflict, two to three times as many mental health problems, two to three times as many infections, two to three times as many injuries, and twice as much substance abuse. Feeling powerless is linked with higher death rates from cardiovascular disease. The more powerless a person feels, the faster the disease progresses. Bosses live the longest, healthiest lives because they have the most power. As power diminishes, stress rises and health deteriorates. Less education, lower income, and higher unemployment are all linked with more deaths from cardiovascular disease. Children show rising levels of stress hormones as their social position falls. Nurses who work under unfair and unreasonable bosses suffer higher blood pressure. Simply speaking with someone whose social status is higher will raise a person's blood pressure. Higher rates of chronic disease in the working class, and especially in its oppressed sections, are not only the result of obvious factors, inferior nutrition, less medical care, more dangerous work, greater exposure to environmental toxins, etc. Continuous, damaging stress results when people are put down and ordered around their entire lives. Stress triggers a higher heart rate, a release of adrenaline, glucose, and other neurological responses to help the body respond to a short-term threat. But when extended over long periods of time, they can harm the cardiovascular and immune systems, making individuals more vulnerable to a wide range of conditions, including infections, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart attack, stroke, asthma, and aggression. It makes sense that inequality would make people sick. Human survival has always depended on cooperation and strong social bonds. Social support is linked with better health and longer life. Strong social ties explain why Hispanic Americans have less chronic illness than white Americans, despite having lower incomes. Inequality ruptures social bonds. Exclusion from the decision-making process is strongly linked with heart disease. Since capitalism excludes the majority from the decision-making process, it is not surprising that heart disease has become a leading cause of death. No matter how you look at it, ending inequality would reduce the burden of disease and raise the level of health more than any other single measure. Our early ancestors preserved social ties by valuing equality and reciprocity. Cultural practices of gift-giving, food-sharing, and making collective decisions were accompanied by social taboos against selfishness, snobbery, and greed. By rejecting these ancient values and setting people against one another, capitalism has created a world of sickness. Sadly, the medical system is designed not to eliminate the misery, but to profit from it. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. Caring for profit. In medicine, business comes first. I learned this as a medical intern in a big city hospital. One morning, a 67-year-old man who was waiting for a hernia repair asked me to cancel his surgery because he had a strong feeling that he would die on the operating table. When I conveyed this information to the surgeon, he became furious. Storming into the patient's room, the doctor berated the patient for wasting his time. The patient submitted, the surgery proceeded, and the patient died. The surgeon was paid just the same. In a social system where human needs come first, the medical system would be organized to promote health and prevent disease. Under capitalism, the medical system is organized to produce profit, and there is no profit in health. Healthy people don't need doctors, hospitals, and medicines. In contrast, disease is a highly profitable gold mine. People will pay anything to relieve their suffering and care for their loved ones. Our, quote, healthcare system is really a disease care system because most medical spending is devoted to treating disease, not preventing it. Consider the following example. Over 100 years ago, Louis Pasteur discovered the link between germs and disease. Today, modern hospitals spread disease because it is not profitable to keep them clean. Hygiene is so inadequate in most American hospitals that 1 out of every 20 patients contracts an infection during a hospital stay. Hospital infections kill an estimated 103,000 people in the United States a year, as many as AIDS, breast cancer, and auto accidents combined. In 2005, New York City's Mount Sinai Hospital experienced an outbreak of illness that is caused when fecal material from one person enters another person's mouth. The germs were being transmitted by nursing assistants who wore the same clothes while emptying bedpans and delivering food trays. These workers were not provided with enough time to change their clothes between duties. Most infections caught in hospitals could be prevented by basic sanitation. However, keeping hospitals clean is labor-intensive work. Sanitizing surfaces, changing clothes, and washing hands absorbs time that could be invested in profit-making activities. As a result, budget-squeezed hospitals tend to cut cleaning staff and rely on antibiotics to manage infections. The overuse of antibiotics has caused more than 70% of hospital-acquired infections to become antibiotic-resistant and more deadly. The greatest profits flow from denying people medical treatment. While medical insurance companies promise to provide care in times of need, they profit by withholding care, charging high premiums, enrolling only the healthiest individuals, denying coverage for pre-existing ailments, demanding co-payments and deductibles, limiting payouts, and reserving the right to abandon programs and regions that provide them with insufficient profits. In the movie John Q, the lead character is a factory worker whose insurance company refuses to pay for his son's heart transplant. In real life, former Humana evaluator Dr. Linda Pino testified before Congress that she was pressured to deny a heart transplant to a patient who died as a result. She stated, "Humana's only concern was cost. The young man fit all the criteria. A donor had been found. His doctor was ready to do the operation. Humana proved that it had no heart when it purchased a sculpture for its head office that cost as much as the transplant would have cost." As medical care becomes more expensive, more employers are shifting the cost to workers, who then have less money for housing, food, transportation, and childcare. A Harvard study found that half of U.S. bankruptcies affecting 2 million people annually are caused by sickness or medical bills. 3/4 of those bankrupted by illness had medical insurance when they first got sick. One doctor concluded, "It's a cruel irony that in trying to help our patients, we often ruin them financially. We heal their bodies, but inflict lasting financial wounds." Close quote. Medical capitalism. Organizing medicine as a business is profitable for some and lethal for many others. In 2003, New York Times reporters Walt Bogdanich and Eric Coley revealed how Bayer Pharmaceutical Company knowingly allowed hemophiliacs to be infected with HIV. Hemophilia is caused by a lack of clotting factors in the blood and is treated with regular injections of a blood product that is concentrated from pools of donors. In March of 1983, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control reported that 74% of hemophiliacs who were using unheated blood concentrate were testing positive for HIV. Bayer had developed a heat-treated product that was free of HIV. Nevertheless, for more than a year, the company continued to sell its unsafe product in Argentina, Japan, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, and Taiwan. According to company documents, Bayer did not want to be stuck with large supplies of a product that could not be sold in the U.S. and Europe. So Bayer instructed its Hong Kong distributor to use up stocks of the old product before switching to the newer, safer one. Even after it began selling the heat-treated product, Bayer continued to make the unheated product for several months because it was cheaper to produce, and the company had several fixed-price contracts. In total, Bayer exported more than 100,000 vials of unheated concentrate after its safer product was available. In May of 1965, an official at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration stated that, quote, it was unacceptable for Bayer to ship that material overseas, but requested that the issue be quietly solved without alerting Congress, the medical community, and the public. Bayer continued to ship unheated concentrate for another 2 months. Bayer was not unique in selling death for profit. Three other American-based companies, Armour Pharmaceutical, Baxter International, and Alpha Therapeutic, also sold unheated blood concentrate after developing a heat-treated product. Bogdanich and Coley cite the case of the 42-year-old hemophiliac Li Ching Chang, who lived in Taiwan and became HIV positive after using Bayer's unheated blood concentrate. Who knows how many more hemophiliacs were infected? No amount of regulation can stop the production of harmful drugs and devices if enough profit can be made by selling them. In 2003, the Guidant Corporation pleaded guilty to 10 felonies, admitting that it lied to the U.S. government and hid thousands of serious health problems, including 12 deaths caused by a defect in one of its medical devices. Guidant was rushing to compete with a company whose medical device was approved by the FDA the same day that Guidant's device was approved. As of this writing, Guidant is still in business, despite continuing problems with defective devices. It is a sick fact that corporations profit by suppressing evidence that their products can kill. GlaxoSmithKline knowingly marketed antidepressants that increased the risk of suicide in children. Merck knowingly produced a painkiller that doubled the risk of heart attack and stroke. Pfizer knowingly sold a similar painkiller that more than tripled the risk of heart attacks, strokes, and death. AstraZeneca knowingly promised an anti-cholesterol drug that resulted in 75 times more kidney failure than all of its competitors combined. This is a partial list of incidents in 1 year from one industry. As long as profit rules, the safety of products cannot be guaranteed. The role of the state. The state has a conflict regarding matters of health. To preserve the capitalist system, the state must ignore the systemic causes of disease. At the same time, sick workers are less productive. One U.S. study found that the time off work due to illness costs the economy $260 billion a year. To counter this loss, the state must ensure some level of medical care. In the United States, about 100 million people, one in three, have access to medical care through government-funded programs like Medicare, Medicaid, the military, and government employee health plans. These programs make the U.S. government the largest provider of medical care in America. However, providing everyone with medical care would undermine the profitability of the American medical system. Dr. David Himmelstein calculates, quote, there's something like $50 billion a year in profits extracted from the healthcare system, and that's only about one-sixth as much as the bureaucratic costs of actually extracting that profit. In fact, we spend each year about $320 billion or $340 billion on useless bureaucratic work in order to apportion the right to health care according to ability to pay, enforce inequality in care, and enforce the collection of profit by insurance companies, for-profit hospitals, the drug industry, a whole panoply of players, close quote. To generate profits, people must be denied medical care. In 2005, the average annual insurance premium for a family of four was $10,880, more than the entire annual income of a full-time minimum wage worker. This fee does not include the cost of deductibles, copayments, and non-insured medical treatments. As a result, 28% of Americans had no medical insurance at all. More than 40% of Americans making between $20,000 and $40,000 had no medical insurance for some portion of the year, and 67% of the uninsured lived in families with at least one full-time worker. People without medical insurance are more likely to be admitted to hospital for preventable conditions, and they die at almost twice the rate of those with insurance. The Institute of Medicine estimates that 18,000 unnecessary deaths result every year from a lack of medical insurance. When the Institute recommended that the federal government provide medical coverage for all Americans, Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson replied that universal medical coverage was unrealistic. He didn't say that it wasn't affordable. In 2004, the U.S. government spent $2 trillion on medical care, an average of $6,820 per person, which is more than any other government in the world, including those that offer universal medical care. In effect, the U.S. government could provide top-notch medical care for all Americans without spending a penny more than it already does. Dr. Steffi Woolhandler points out, quote, "We pay the world's highest health care taxes, but much of the money is squandered. The wealthy get tax deductions for medical care, and HMOs and drug companies pocket billions in profits at the taxpayers' expense. But politicians claim we can't afford universal coverage. We already pay for it, but we don't get it." Close quote. Politicians have no problem with police, emergency, military, and firefighting services being publicly funded and administered. Healthcare is treated differently because big business insists on it. To defend their profits, medical insurance companies contribute more money to federal politicians than banks, military contractors, oil and gas companies, and the real estate industry. The top lobby group is the pharmaceutical industry, which also has the most profitable business in America. In 2004 alone, drug companies paid 1,291 lobbyists $123 million to influence various levels of government. Favorable legislation is not the only result. The government contributes more money to the development of new drugs than any other government in the world. There is a revolving door between Washington and the pharmaceutical industry, with a pot of gold on both sides. A 2005 report for the Center for Public Integrity found that one-third of the 3,000 lobbyists employed by the drug industry were former federal government employees, with more than 75 being former members of Congress. Here's one example of how it works. Over 15 years, the drug industry donated more than $200,000 to Congressman Billy Tawson's election campaign. In return, Tawson designed a Medicare law that expressly forbids government from negotiating lower drug prices. In 2004, Tawson's loyalty was rewarded when he traded in his $158,100 legislative post for a $2 million a year job as president of the drug industry's chief lobby group, the Pharmaceutical and Research Manufacturers of America. The tight relationship between Washington and the drug industry makes a joke out of the Food and Drug Administration's mandate to protect the public from harmful drugs. The FDA serves the drug industry by providing rapid drug approval with minimal testing and by covering up problems that occur after drugs are approved. When a class of FDA-approved antiarthritis drugs were found to increase the risk of death, the FDA did not rush to protect the public. On the contrary, an FDA scientist was pressured not to publish his finding that one of these drugs has caused as many as 140,000 incidents of heart disease and 56,000 deaths over a period of 5 years. When the bad news finally broke, Washington protected the drug industry, not the public. Drug companies had made billions of dollars selling these dangerous products, and they could afford to pay for the harm they'd caused. Nevertheless, the White House ruled that drug companies did not have to pay punitive damages caused by drugs and medical devices that the FDA had approved. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. A pill for every ill. Eliminating class divisions would be the best way to improve human health. However, the medical system does not challenge the class system because it is an integral part of it. The treatment of disease is limited to the treatment of individuals. In essence, the symptoms of class inequality, sickness, injury, and premature death, are dissociated from their social roots and classified as individual medical problems. This approach is highly profitable for the pharmaceutical industry. When continuous stress elevates blood pressure and cholesterol and irritates the stomach lining, these symptoms are given medical diagnoses: hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, hyperacidity, that suggest they are distinct diseases. Once a symptom is labeled as a disease or medical condition, a drug can be developed to treat it. Sometimes the drug comes first and the disease comes later. The 9 top-selling drugs in the world treat symptoms. 1 lowers blood pressure, 2 lower cholesterol, 3 reduce stomach acid, 2 are antidepressants, and 1 reduces pain and inflammation. In the United States, the top 3 selling drug categories are antidepressants, anti-stomach acid reducers, and cholesterol reducers. Lipitor, a drug that lowers blood cholesterol, is the top selling drug in the U.S., with sales of nearly $10 billion in 2003. The $500 billion a year U.S. drug industry works hard to ensure that the preferred treatment for every ailment is a drug, preferably an expensive one. Consider the problem of child bedwetting. Ferring Pharmaceuticals promotes a drug that claims to prevent this problem. One advertisement shows a smiling child underlined with the caption, "Not only is there hope for bedwetting, but now it can happen as early as age 5. The ad concludes, "Bedwetting is a medical condition that, when left untreated, can be harmful to a child's self-esteem." Close quote. In fact, most children wet their beds because their urinary systems are not fully developed, and bedwetting stops as children mature. At age 5, about 16% of children wet their beds. By age 8, this figure has dropped by half. By 12 years of age, only 3% wet the bed, and by age 15, only 1% have wet beds. Experts advise that patience and understanding are the best response to childhood bedwetting. The problem is that most parents do not have time to change the bed every morning, do extra laundry, and reassure their kids. Physicians are not paid to reassure parents or to teach them how to use non-drug methods to reduce bedwetting. Instead of providing reassurance, Ferring plays up the shame of bedwetting and offers to rescue parents, children, and physicians with a drug that costs about $200 per month. Adverse effects listed for this drug include headaches, nosebleeds, chills, dizziness, nausea, abdominal pain, wheezing, skin rash, and in rare cases, lethargy, mental impairment, seizures, and coma. Treating social problems as individual medical conditions has made the pharmaceutical industry the most profitable business in America. 44% of Americans take at least 1 prescription medication, and 17% take 3 or more. 62% of people visiting doctors' offices or hospital outpatient departments leave with a prescription, regardless of the reason for their visit. Retail pharmacies dispense close to $200 billion worth of drugs a year. The top 10 drug companies enjoy a 30% profit margin, almost double the profit margin of commercial banks. Their products are so expensive that 26% of seniors take less medicine than they are prescribed, or go without entirely. Both the drug industry and the government insist that high profits are necessary to develop new medicines. In reality, the industry spends about $60 billion a year marketing drugs, which is nearly double what it spends on research and development. Manufacturers of brand-name drugs employ 80% more people in marketing than in research. And between 1995 and 2000, Drug companies hired 59% more marketing employees while cutting back on the number of research workers. Under capitalism, the function of the pharmaceutical industry is to make profit, not to treat disease. To promote their products, drug companies finance or directly provide the bulk of physician education. In 1997, the FDA made it easier for the pharmaceutical industry to market prescription drugs directly to consumers. By 2005, drug companies were spending $4 billion a year on television and print ads to give their products the same level of brand recognition enjoyed by popular soft drinks and breakfast cereals. The more drugs are advertised, the more patients request them, and the more doctors prescribe them. One study found that more than 70% of doctors prescribed the drug their patients demanded. In half these cases, doctors admitted that they prescribed the drug only because the patient asked for it. Some drug companies go so far as to offer coupons, free samples, free trials, and money-back guarantees for prescription drugs. One group of Florida residents found a month's supply of Prozac in their mailboxes. The recipients were not taking this drug, had not requested it, and had no idea why they received it. Information from medical and pharmaceutical records had been used to identify people who might try this antidepressant. It is more profitable for drug companies to repackage existing medicines than to invest in developing new ones. Since the 1990s, the number of new drugs approved by the Food and Drug Administration has fallen steadily. Most of the 1,035 drugs approved by the FDA between 1989 and 2000 were Me Too drugs that were basically more expensive versions of already existing medicines. For instance, advertisements tout Clarinex as a superior anti-allergy medicine. In fact, Clarinex is a remake of Claritin, a drug that was about to use its patent protection, drop in price, and provide less profit. Poor people cannot afford medicine, so there is no profit in developing treatment for diseases that afflict them. Consequently, only 10% of global medical research is devoted to finding treatments for 90% of diseases. In 1990, a fluorouracil hydrochloride was licensed as a medicine to treat sleeping sickness, a disease that kills thousands of people in Africa every year. In 1995, production was stopped because African patients could not afford to buy this medicine. When a fluorouracil was found to reduce unwanted facial hair, the drug was repackaged as a skin cream and marketed to women in the U.S. Inventing disease. While people die from diseases that are not profitable to treat, drug companies invent medical conditions to sell drugs to those who can pay. A letter from Merck Frost informs physicians, quote, "A new campaign to promote disease awareness for male pattern hair loss is now appearing on television and other media. A follow-up on last year's radio campaign, this latest undertaking is expected to motivate an increased number of male patients to speak to their doctors about hair loss." Close quote. Since when is baldness a disease? Since Merck developed a drug to treat hair loss. 1 month's treatment costs about $60, and the product remains effective only with continual use. Merck's campaign to promote disease awareness aims to increase discontent with baldness, thereby creating the very condition that Merck aims to treat. The more drug companies blur the boundary lines between normal processes and disease states, the more drugs they can sell. Wyeth manufactures Premarin, a hormone designed to treat symptoms of menopause. Many women have no problem with menopause. However, some suffer hot flashes, night sweats, insomnia, and other distressing symptoms. For those who can find no relief, hormone treatment can be helpful. However, Wyeth's profits would be much greater if all menopausal women took hormone replacement therapy, HRT, for the rest of their lives. To make this happen, menopause itself would need to become a disease. Wyeth found the man for the job in Dr. Robert Wilson, whose 1968 bestseller, Feminine Forever, insists that menopause is both unnecessary and harmful and promotes estrogen as a fountain of youth for the dull and unattractive menopausal woman. In a separate article, Wilson warns that declining female hormones constitute a potentially fatal deficiency disease. Wyeth was more than happy to fund Wilson's book, his research foundation, and his promotional tours. Wyeth joined with other pharmaceutical companies to fund the North American Menopause Society, a major promoter of HRT. Physicians and medical researchers were funded by the drug companies to give talks praising HRT at scientific conferences. Scientists were commissioned to write articles promoting HRT for respected medical journals, and these articles were used as medical education for doctors. The campaign to promote HRT was so successful that an advisory committee to the FDA recommended that HRT be approved to prevent heart disease, despite the complete absence of any evidence to support this claim. The National Women's Health Network opposed this mass experiment on women and demanded that studies be done to assess the actual benefits and risks of HRT. Over the objection of Wyeth-funded scientists, the FDA actually launched a study in the fall of 1997. The study was stopped prematurely when it was discovered that the women taking HRT showed higher rates of coronary artery disease, stroke, and breast cancer than the women who took the placebo. Women taking HRT were also twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. It was a huge scandal. For 25 years, doctors had been prescribing harmful drugs to millions of healthy women. National Women's Health Network Director Cynthia Pearson explained, quote, "There was never one single clinical trial that showed that HRT prevented cardiovascular disease or stroke. The belief that hormones are good preventive medicine has been a triumph of marketing over science. Women who took HRT were placed in the way of harm by their physicians, who acted as unsuspecting patsies for pharmaceutical companies," close quote. Wyeth suffered no penalty. Barely a year later, a full-page ad in a medical publication announced that Wyeth was proud of past accomplishments and trumpeted its commitment to a single mission, leading the way to a healthier world, close quote. The entire HRT scandal might as well have happened in the Twilight Zone. At its 2002 annual conference, the Endocrine Society recommended that every man over age 50 be screened for testosterone deficiency. This conference was funded by Solvay Pharma, a pharmaceutical giant that manufactures testosterone gel. This same company provides research grants, speaking fees, public relations communications, and direct-to-consumer advertising urging tired, depressed men with low sex drive to ask their doctors about testosterone replacement. This HRT campaign for men was launched despite the fact that testosterone can increase the risk of prostate cancer and cardiovascular disease. A pattern has developed where medical conditions appear as drugs are developed to treat them. Social phobia to sell Paxil, erectile dysfunction to sell Viagra, pseudobulbar affect, uncontrollable laughing or crying to sell Neurodex, overactive bladder to sell anticholinergic drugs, and hyperhidrosis, excessive sweating, to sell Botox. As pharmaceutical companies push the boundaries of disease, the healthy person becomes someone who has not yet been diagnosed with a medical condition that can be treated with a drug. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The definition of mental illness has always been political. During slavery days, experts argued that black people were psychologically suited to a life of slavery, so that there must be something wrong with those who rebelled. The diagnosis of drapetomania, an intense desire to run away, was developed in 1851 to explain why slaves kept trying to escape. The racist delusion that black people liked being slaves could also be considered a sign of mental illness. Who decides which behavior is normal or healthy, and which behavior is sick or deviant? Before the 20th century, the stresses of life were considered to be either spiritual issues or physical illnesses, and people turned either to their religious advisors or their physicians for relief. Medical doctors treated hysteria and nerves as physical problems. Psychiatry was restricted to the treatment of severely disturbed people in asylums. There was no concept or treatment of mental illness outside of institutions. In 1918, the first classification of psychiatric disorders in the United States contained 22 categories, and all but one referred to various forms of insanity. During the early 20th century, Sigmund Freud revolutionized psychiatry by breaking down the barrier between mental illness and normal behavior. In his 1901 book, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, Freud argued that commonplace occurrences, slips of the tongue, what people find humorous, what they forget, and the mistakes they make indicate repressed sexual feelings that lurk beneath the surface of normal behavior. By linking everyday occurrences with mental illness, Freud and his followers released psychiatry from the asylum and began to treat people with a broad range of problems. Between 1917 and 1970, the proportion of psychiatrists practicing outside institutions swelled from 8% to 66%. The social movements of the 1960s opposed psychiatry's exclusive focus on inner conflict and highlighted the social sources of human misery. Dr. Alvin Poussin recalls the 1969 convention of the American Psychiatric Association, the APA. After multiple racist killings during the civil rights movement, a group of black psychiatrists sought to have murderous bigotry based on race classified as a mental disorder. The APA's officials rejected that recommendation, arguing that since so many Americans are racist, racism in this country is normative. Close quote. In 1980, the APA expanded the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. According to the task force established to create the new manual, any disorder could be included, quote, if there is general agreement among clinicians who would be expected to encounter the condition, that there are significant numbers of patients who have it, and that its identification is important in the clinical work, close quote. In other words, the new DSM was not based on science, but on the need to maintain existing patients and to include new ones who might seek treatment for any number of problems. A profitable and self-perpetuating industry was born. By 1994, the DSM listed 400 distinct mental disorders covering a wide range of behaviors in adults and children. Racism, homophobia, fear of homosexuality, and misogyny, hatred of women, have never been listed as mental disorders in the DSM. Homosexuality was listed. In They Say You're Crazy, How the World's Most Powerful Psychiatrists Decide Who's Normal, Paula Kaplan protests, quote, in a culture that scorns and demeans lesbians and gay men, it is hard to be completely comfortable with one's homosexuality. And so the DSM-3 authors were treating as a mental disorder what was often simply a perfectly comprehensible reaction to being mocked and oppressed. The women's movement condemned labeling the effects of oppression as symptoms of mental illness. Paula Kaplan describes efforts to prevent masochistic personality disorder, MPD, from being included in the DSM. Among other things, this disorder assumes that women who stay with abusive spouses do so because they like to suffer, not because they lack the resources to leave. Despite protest, MPD was included in the 1987 edition of the DSM, although it was later dropped. The DSM inclusion of premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, also raised a protest. According to Kaplan, quote, "The problem with PMDD is not the women who report premenstrual mood problems, but the diagnosis of PMDD itself. Excellent research shows that these women are significantly more likely than other women to be in upsetting life situations, such as being battered or mistreated at work. To label them mentally disordered, to send the message that their problems are individual psychological ones, hides the real external sources of their trouble," close quote. Eli Lilly campaigned to have PMDD listed in the DSM so it could repackage its best-selling drug Prozac in a pink pill format, rename it Serafem, and promote it as a treatment for PMDD. Bastards! By creating Serafem, Eli Lilly was able to extend its patent and its profits on the Prozac formula for another 7 years. PMDD continues to be listed as a mental disorder. Is everybody crazy? Capitalism denies most people control over their lives and needs them to believe that this condition is normal. Anxiety, depression, and other stress reactions are treated as signs of personal inadequacy, biological defects, mental illness, anything other than as reasonable responses to unreasonable conditions. The result is a highly profitable form of social control. In 2005, American researchers announced that about half of Americans will meet the criteria for a DSM-IV disorder sometime in their life. How can we explain this? Has it become normal to be mentally ill? Or has the definition of mental illness expanded beyond reason? Both are true. Capitalism produces an immense amount of suffering. At the same time, defining more people as mentally ill takes the focus off social problems and boosts drug sales. Most people know the difference between normal behavior, such as grief over the death of a loved one, and abnormal behavior, that could indicate an internal disorder, such as grief for no apparent reason or beyond what would normally be expected. However, the DSM lists and categorizes symptoms without regard to what is happening in people's lives. As a result, surveys based on DSM categories inflate the number of people who can be classified as mentally ill. This is no accident. In 2006, a medical journal revealed that most of the scientists, psychiatrists, and other experts who worked on the DSM had financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry. Every new mental disorder listed in the DSM is worth millions to drug companies. The FDA will not approve a drug to treat a mental condition that does not appear in the DSM, giving the pharmaceutical industry a financial interest in maximizing the number of mental disorders listed. Along with inflated rates of mental illness comes the warning that too many mentally ill people are not getting treatment. The question of whether all the people who are designated as sick are actually sick is never raised. Many people suffer from overwork, unemployment, excessive family responsibilities, illness, death of loved ones, and severe financial stress, all of which can cause feelings and behaviors that are similar to those seen with mental illness. Rates of mental illness are also inflated by equating the extent of an illness with the number of prescriptions for drugs used to treat that illness. By this measure, the rate of depression in the U.S. has gone through the roof. In 1980, there were 10 million prescriptions dispensed for antidepressant drugs. 20 years later, this figure had jumped to 170 million prescriptions. Hey, the population is only 300 million. I'm just interjecting that. Antidepressants are the top-selling category of drugs in America, with billions of dollars in retail sales every year. This dramatic rise in drug sales is the result of increasing human misery plus highly successful marketing. Studies have shown that the number of prescriptions written for antidepressants is linked to the amount of money spent on promoting them. One drug company runs full-page glossy ads urging doctors to look for the Paxil spectrum in every patient in the hope that physicians will prescribe this antidepressant for more troubled people. Sick people, healthy profits. As living standards decline, the emphasis on drugs increases. Between 30 and 40,000 people die from influenza every year in the U.S. Instead of correcting the social conditions that favor the spread of infectious disease, people pressured to go to work sick, stressed families, crowded classrooms, poor nutrition, and increased pollution, public officials pushed the flu vaccine. This strategy has neither lessened the incidence of flu nor reduced the number of flu-related deaths. Nevertheless, President Bush asked Congress for $7 billion to stockpile vaccines and other drugs to fight avian flu. It may be a coincidence that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld owns $25 million worth of shares in the company that developed the avian flu vaccine. The pharmaceutical industry, the medical system, and the state all treat illness not as a social problem that requires social solutions, but as an individual problem that requires individual treatments. A good example is schizophrenia, an illness that is assumed to be genetic and is commonly treated with drugs. Studies from several countries show that living in a city gives a person a higher probability of developing schizophrenia than having a family member with the disease. Moving from rural to urban centers increases the risk of developing schizophrenia, while moving in the other direction reduces the risk. What could explain such patterns? City living is associated with increased exposure to lead, infection, malnutrition, stress, trauma, and racial discrimination, all of which have been linked with higher rates of schizophrenia. Instead of demanding improved social conditions to reduce schizophrenia, the medical system extracts the individual from society, splits the brain from the body, severs the mind from the brain, and drugs the brain. Why people put up with such treatment is the subject of Part 3. Summary. The cost of doing business under capitalism is disease, disability, and premature death. Inequality on its own is a major source of sickness. The medical system disguises social problems as individual medical illnesses and services only those who can pay. The most effective way to improve human health is to improve social conditions. Under capitalism, drugs are preferred because they support the status quo and provide profits in the process. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 8, Profit from Pain, and the conclusion of Part 2 of Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. And we'll continue with Power and Powerlessness next week. In the meantime, if you can't wait, you can obtain the entire book in various forms through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours. If you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. And thanks to those of you who have already sent in questions. I've enjoyed reading them. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. They'll take the money.